All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it is October 20th, and we're going to finish up central nervous system and move into peripheral nervous system today. But let me see, I got a feeling something's happening. What's happening? What's happening? Not much, just lecture this week. And all the practicums are done. Some of the sections I've graded already, some I haven't. But let's see, today is the 20th, but I have that wrong on your schedule. I have it as the 21st, but it's not the 21st. Today is really the 20th, and is this about 231? It sure is. All right, so we're going to get into peripheral nervous system today, finish up central, but that also means then on Monday, which is the 25th, good news is your third exam on chapters 10, 11, and 12, which is skeletal muscle, introduction to skeletal muscle, muscles of the body, and then introduction to nervous system, which is chapter 12. And the reason why that's good news, then you only have two tests after that. So the semester is like almost over already. That's unreal. All right, so let's see. I don't have the page numbers on here, but we've covered hundreds of pages already. All right, so let's finish up with central nervous system, review maybe just a little bit of the spinal cord, and then talk about the membranes that surround and protect the brain and cerebral spinal fluid flow and pathways, and I think we're pretty much done with central nervous system. I think we got a little bit in reflexes, but we've talked about reflexes quite a bit already. So where do you find the spinal cord? From where to where? Superiorly, it begins at the... Yeah, you're right, you're pointing to it, but I don't have any way to grade you on that. The foramen magnum, right? So here's foramen magnum right here, right? So that's the beginning of the spinal cord. And, well, let's just review a little bit further. If you go above the foramen magnum, superior to foramen magnum, that's no longer spinal cord, but what part of the brain is that then? Brain stem. And what's the first part of the brain stem? The medulla oblongata. Yep. Okay. And then the pons is above that, and indeed you're right, that's the brain stem. All right, so the spinal cord goes from foramen magnum to about L2 that we see right here. And the very tip is called the conus medullaris. There are nerves in the vertebral canal that extend below the level of L2, and that's what we call the cauda equina. So those exit the intervertebral foramina or the sacral foramina. And there's also a ligament that puts a little bit of traction on the conus medullaris so that it doesn't retract back up to the brain, and that's called the phylum terminale. All right, so I think we did talk about all that stuff last time. All right, so we're pretty much on track. So here is a nice transverse. Oh, yeah, now I remember. We were on this slide. All right, so this is a nice, because I asked what level of the spinal cord is this, and somebody said, oh, cervical, and how do you know? Well, because of the vertebral foramina and the bifid spinous process right here. All right, so a bit different compared to the cerebrum, the gray matter is deep in the spinal cord, and white matter is superficial. In the cerebrum, it's the other way around. Cortical is gray matter. All right, and so we see that there are two ways that nerves can interact with the spinal cord, and it could be through these two different routes. These are routes. And this one is the dorsal root, and this is the ventral root. Usually we do not say anterior and posterior. Usually we say dorsal and ventral when it comes to these roots. And remember, a neuron can only transmit information in one direction. And all the neurons are aligned in the same direction in these roots. So roots are 100% afferent or 100% efferent. And you got to know that the dorsal root is 100% afferent. The ventral root is 100% efferent, right? There's no mixing of signals. But when the roots join together right here to form this spinal nerve, and we call this a spinal nerve because it originates from the spinal cord and not the brain, so this is a spinal nerve, right? A spinal nerve is what we call mixed. It carries both afferent and efferent signals. Okay. So that's pretty good for this figure. Now, we'll talk about this figure again a little bit later because it shows the membranes around the central nervous system nicely. All right, this probably is an exam figure. because it shows some important anatomy of the spinal cord, and indeed this is real important for lab as well. All right, so remember that white matter is superficial. These carry myelinated axons, either afferent or efferent axons, and what do we call a group of myelinated axons carrying information in the central nervous system someplace? Myelinated axons in the CNS are called tracts. All right, so these carry tracts, either afferent tracts or efferent tracts, and that's why it looks like white matter. And sometimes we call these columns because they're either going up or down. Another name for a column is a funiculus. And so we, on one side of the spinal cord, we have three different kinds of funiculi. Here is the anterior or ventral funiculus. Here's the lateral funiculus. Here is the dorsal funiculus. Just by location in the spinal cord. And these tracts pretty much are arranged according to the architecture of the brain. So what is the frontal lobe primarily known for? Motor, right? So these tracts mostly in the ventral funiculus right here, most of these are descending tracts or efferent tracts. While in the posterior funiculus right here, most of these are afferent tracts. It doesn't always obey that rule, but that's pretty much the case. All right, now in this gray matter right here, we can't have tracts. How come we can't have tracts in the gray matter? Because it's not myelinated, and the other reason is because you only have nerve cell bodies and dendrites right here. There are no axons, right? Very, very few axons, and so it looks gray. These different areas of the gray matter are what we call horns. So here we have the posterior horn or dorsal horn. Here's anterior or ventral horn, and then here is the lateral horn. And we have nerve cell bodies and dendrites in this region. All right, so here we have a root. What's the function of this root? What root is that? That's the ventral root, and its function is motor, right? It's efferent. And so this is where we have nerve cell bodies and dendrites of efferent nerves, multipolar neurons, right? Have their cell body here, and then the axon comes out the ventral root, right? So that's what you have in this ventral horn. In the lateral horn, you have nerve cell bodies and dendrites of a part of the autonomic nervous system. But again, they're motor fibers that leave the ventral root. We're going to talk about autonomic nervous system. It has its own chapter in two chapters. And then this dorsal horn right here is just where you have nerve cell bodies of association neurons, which is going to be sharing information within the dorsal horn. You have pathways between the right and left side of the spinal cord through this gray commissure. And what is a commissural tract? Actually, there are three kinds of tracts. There are commissural, projection, and association tracts. And I think I talked about that last time. Commissural tracts take information from one side of the central nervous system to the other, from right to left. Right, like the right side of the cerebral hemisphere over to the left side of the cerebral hemisphere, and those tracts would go through that corpus callosum, for instance, because that corpus callosum is white matter. Right? Projection tracts take information that ascend or information that descend through the brain, like through the internal capsule, and then association tracts carry information from one gyrus to another gyrus on the same side of the cerebrum. All right, so when you see that term commissure, it means what? Sharing of information from one side of the CNS to the other, like left to right, for instance. All right, we have some fissures and sulci in the spinal cord as well. Here's the dorsal median sulcus. It's a pretty deep invagination. Almost goes all the way over to the gray commissure right here, but not quite. And then here is the ventral median fissure. What does median mean? Right smack in the middle. Right smack in the middle. Okay. And then here we have the central canal, which is carrying cerebrospinal fluid from the third ventricle all the way down to the tip of the spinal cord. What do we call that tip of the spinal cord? The very distal part of the spinal cord? Starts with a C. Two words. Reminds me of ice cream. It's the conus medullaris, okay, conus medullaris. Cerebrospinal fluid flows all the way down to the tip of the spinal cord. All right, we're going to talk about the meninges, which are the membranes that surround the central nervous system, and maybe this is a good place to kind of start to talk about it. All right, the three layers from superficial to deep, the toughest, thickest one, which you're going to have to dissect off your sheep brains in lab. This is the dura mater right here. And what is that? What does dura really mean in English? Durable, hard, tough, right? That's the thickest one. The intermediate layer is called the arachnoid mater. And then the most delicate layer right here that covers every little crevice and bend and wiggle in the surface of the central nervous system, we call that the pia mater. Okay, so you got the pia, then you've got the arachnoid, and then the dura mater right here. And it goes, and it surrounds the brain as well. All right, so let me refer to my word slide. Only one projector is working, unfortunately. So I can't show you the word slides and the picture slides at the same time. Okay, so that's good. I think we covered pretty much everything in the spinal cord. Right, the ways in, the motor pathways, the afferent pathways. Let's talk about tracts. You have a number of tracts in your body and in your book, but I only want you to know about two of them. I want you to know about the spinal thalamic tract and the cortical spinal tract. And I'm going to talk about this a little bit. The nomenclature that we're going to use here is the same that's used for muscles. All right, sometimes a muscle is named after its origin and its insertion, like the sternocleidomastoid. And one part is the sternum, and the other part is the mastoid process. And remember, a muscle has two ends. It has an origin and an insertion. So when a muscle is named by origin and insertion, what comes first? Does the origin or the insertion come first in that word? Origin first, insertion comes second. Okay. So we use kind of that same nomenclature to name some tracts in the spinal cord. And they're named after where they originate from and then where they carry information to. And then what do? With those two words? We put an O between them. For instance, spinothalamic tract is carrying information between what two parts of your central nervous system? The spinal cord and the thalamus. Okay, and it goes from where it is originating from and then ending in where it's going. So is this a afferent or an efferent tract? Spinothalamic. It's going from the spinal cord, ascending to the thalamus. Can you picture where the thalamus is? Well, certainly after lab because you're going to dissect one out. But the thalamus is right on the top of the diencephalon, kind of right in the middle of the brain. So this is what? An afferent tract. It's a sensory tract. Spinal thalamic tract is a very important sensory tract, and as a matter of fact, in parentheses, if you want to put pain, put that in parentheses because it carries pain sensation to your brain. Not that I want you to experience pain, but it's important if a part of your body is being damaged, right? So you can respond to that damaging stimulus. All right, what about cortical spinal tract? Where is it originating from? Cortical is the cortex, right? The cerebral cortex. And where is it going to end up? The spinal cord. So this is what? An efferent tract within the spinal cord. All right, so let's see if I can find the slide of where these things are at. I think these are kind of at the end of the chapter. All right, let's look here. Nope, next slide. Okay, spinal thalamic pathway, lateral spinal thalamic tract. All right, so here you have, maybe I'll zoom in. All right, so here you have some free nerve endings. And the free nerve endings can sense pain, noxious stimuli, as well as temperature, damaging temperature, like what? Fire. Here's somebody holding a match to your foot. All right, and that's going to set, it's going to be picked up by receptors in the foot, and then action potentials or nerve impulses are going to travel into the central nervous system via this neuron right here. This is what, an afferent neuron? And can you tell me what kind of neuron does that look like? That is a nice unipolar neuron. This is the peripheral process. Here's the central process. Right, and so the cell body of that unipolar neuron is located in, what's this bulge? What's his bulge? These are roots, right here are roots. And does this make sense? Is sensory information going in the correct root of the spinal nerve right here? Because it is what, the dorsal root? The dorsal root is 100% sensory, so this is the dorsal root ganglion. Because a ganglion only contains nerve cell bodies and dendrites, right? And there's thousands, tens of thousands of them here in the dorsal root ganglia. It enters the dorsal root where it synapses, right? Here's a nice chemical synapse. And then that signal crosses over and becomes myelinated as it ascends to the brain through the lateral spinal thalamic tract. That's a pain pathway. And where does it go? It goes to the, so here's spinal cord. It goes to the thalamus, right? So that makes sense. Spinal thalamic tract goes to the thalamus. And what do we find in the thalamus? Another synapse. So it takes how many neurons to get from a receptor to the primary somatosensory cortex in the brain? Yeah, three. Let's go back and count them. First, the afferent neuron into the central nervous system. That's a first-order neuron. Then it synapses, crosses over to the second-order neuron that takes it all the way to the thalamus. And then from the thalamus, right, the job of the thalamus is to take it to the appropriate location in the cerebral cortex, which is the postcentral gyrus, right? And that then takes a third-order neuron to take it there. And when action potentials or nerve impulses reach the cerebral cortex, then you have that sense of pain in that part of the body. Okay, so you got three neurons, right? And one of those neurons, the second order, makes up the lateral spinal thalamic tract. And you can see it going from what? The spinal cord to the thalamus right here. The other one that we talked about is, which one? The corticospinal tract. So it starts in the cortex, right? And it goes down to the spinal cord. So let's take a look at this one. The corticospinal tract is important for taking what kind of signal? Sensory or motor?
Motor?
Motor signals, that's right. Where do motor signals originate from? For skeletal muscle. What part of the brain is important for controlling your skeletal muscles? Voluntary muscle. Think of that central sulcus. The motor cortex is which one? Parietal lobe or frontal lobe? Where do you have the motor in your car? In the front, so the frontal lobe, and in particular, the precentral gyrus is where you have nerve cell bodies and dendrites for controlling skeletal muscle in your body. There is one neuron that goes all the way down. Here is the thalamus. Here are these basal nuclei that we talked about. And these are myelinated tracts, so all of this material here in the central nervous system in the brain is going to look white to you. And so this is what we call the internal capsule. Internal capsule is carrying efferent tracts down to the spinal cord, right? And they cross over, some of them cross over at the level of the medulla. And in the medulla, these things kind of look like pyramids sticking off the ventral side of the medulla. And so, and you can see tracts crossing over on the outside of the brain. So sometimes we call that region where you can see the crisscrossing of nerves or tracts, the crisscrossing of nerves on the surface of the medulla, the decussation of the pyramids. Because these look like pyramids, and that word decussation right there just means crossing over. So the right side of the brain controls the left side of your body. And your left brain controls the right side of your body because these tracts cross over right here. All right, so this is the corticospinal tract, and eventually, all right, what's going to happen? It's going to innervate a skeletal muscle, and when that skeletal muscle receives that nerve impulse, it's going to contract as a result of that. So that is the cortical spinal tract. And so what kind of tract is a cortical spinal tract? It's a motor tract, in particular for what? Skeletal muscles. Not other kinds of muscles in your body like your heart. That's a different kind of nerve, but for voluntary muscle. Okay, so that is not quite done with this chapter. We're familiar with a reflex arc already. We talked about all the different parts of a reflex. It starts with a with a stimulus, right? Then you got a receptor and an afferent neuron, right? Then an association neuron, then a motor neuron going to an effector organ. And what does the effector organ produce? A response, right? And then this is just kind of layered with some other terms like the dorsal root ganglia, because that's where you find the nerve cell body of that sensory neuron, and it has to enter the spinal cord through the dorsal root. That's 100% afferent. Okay, let's talk about the membranes around the brain. Those membranes around the brain are called the meninges. And there are three layers, right, that we talked about. The thick one that's superficial is the dura mater. The one in the middle is the arachnoid. And then the pia mater is the most delicate one that's bound very tightly to every curvature of the surface of the brain and the spinal cord. And there is fluid between some of these layers right here. All right, that fluid is what we call cerebrospinal fluid that helps float the brain to make it lighter so it doesn't get crushed laying on the fossas of the cranial vault. Right, so the brain kind of floats right in there. So let's look at these different layers. All right, and then talk about the flow pattern. Here's a really nice exam figure that shows the three layers very, very nicely. All right, so here we have the integument, some skin right on the scalp. And then we have the bones that make up the cranium, right? These nice flat bones like parietal bone, frontal bone, right here. And maybe I can't tell which one it is. Maybe it's a part of the frontal bone. I don't know. It doesn't really matter too much. All right. And then the membrane on the outside, right, is called the periosteum that surrounds the bone. Well, there's a periosteum, right, on the inner side surface of a bone as well. But it helps make up this deep, periosteum helps make up the meninges. It's a part of the dura mater, right? So we call this the periosteal part of the dura mater. And then there's a tough fibrous part that we call the meningeal layer. So the dura mater has these two layers, the periosteal part and the meningeal part. And right on a mid-sagittal section, these two layers separate, right, and form a cavity that we call a sinus. And this is the superior sagittal sinus, and this actually acts as a vein. It drains blood back from the vein, drains blood from the brain back to the circulatory system. Superior sagittal sinus, remember we said sinuses in the body can contain various things. It could contain air or lymphatic tissue. In this particular case, it's going to contain blood that's going to be delivered back to your circulatory system from the brain. All right, so this is the tough layer, the dura mater. The one right underneath it, not quite so tough, not quite so thick, is the arachnoid. And right below the arachnoid, what's interesting about the arachnoid is that there's a pretty big space. I see a bunch of connective tissue that's helping connect the arachnoid to the pia mater right here, but there's a big space, and in that space you can have some blood vessels, but that space is filled with fluid. And that fluid is cerebrospinal fluid, right? And it flows on the outside of the brain all the way from the bottom of the spinal cord up to the superior sagittal sinus, where there's an invagination of the arachnoid up into this sagittal sinus right here, and that CNS can diffuse through this, what we sometimes call an arachnoid granulation or an arachnoid villus back into the circulatory system so that your body doesn't lose that fluid that's in the subarachnoid space or cerebrospinal fluid. And then the deepest layer of the meninges is the pia mater. And you can see that pia mater following the surface of every, ooh, what is this bump right here? What would you call that bump as opposed to this depression? What's that bump? That's a gyrus. Yeah, the pia mater follows the surface of every gyrus as well as every sulcus on the surface of the brain, right? It's tightly attached to the surface of the brain. Okay. There are some places where the dura mater actually invaginates very deep into the brain. And this space between the cerebral hemispheres right here, right, is not really a sulcus. What do we call this thing between the cerebral hemispheres? Oh, you have to remember this from lab. That's the longitudinal fissure. All right, and the longitudinal fissure also has the full complement of the meninges, including the dura mater, the arachnoid, and the pia mater. And because that it's separating the cerebral hemispheres, we give that tough membrane there a special name. We call that the falx cerebri. It's just a wall separating the cerebral hemispheres, and that goes all the way down to the corpus callosum, and that falx cerebri is only in, what, the longitudinal fissure right there. All right, so those are the three layers of the meninges, but remember, the dura mater actually has these two layers right here. You got to know this structure that arachnoid villus or granulation is for, delivering CSF back to the circulatory system. All right, so how does that cerebral spinal fluid, oh, I do want to show you one last thing. So here's the falx cerebri. All right, there is another part of the dura mater that separates the occipital lobe from what part of the brain is down in this region right here? Cerebellum, yeah, right? And that's called the tentorium, cerebelli. And again, it's dura mater, and it just forms a tent over the cerebellum. It's kind of like the falx cerebri right here, but it separates the occipital lobe from the cerebellum over here. All right, so signals can't go directly from the occipital lobe into the cerebellum, right, because the tentorium is right in the way. How can nerve signals get into the cerebellum? There's a relay station, just like the thalamus relays signals from the spinal cord to the cerebral cortex. There is a relay station from the brain stem into the cerebellum, and that is the pons. The pons, and then the pons send signals through the cerebellar peduncles into the cerebellum. Okay, so let's look at some flow. Oh, this actually shows nicer the falx cerebri and the tentorum. Okay, right here. All right, this shows the flow patterns. So there are spaces, there are cavities inside the brain that we looked at in lab, and they're called ventricles. And here we can see the ventricles nicely that are right on midline. And we can see the ventricle that is at the level of the hypothalamus and the thalamus. This is the one that we call the third ventricle. It receives fluid from the lateral ventricles, which is kind of hard to picture on this particular slide right here because you can't see them on a sagittal section. You need a parasagittal section that takes it way offline. Okay? But nonetheless, each of these chambers in the brain have a special combination of neuroglia cells that are ependymal cells and capillaries that can take fluid from the blood and place it into a ventricle forming cerebral spinal fluid. And that specialized tissue that makes cerebral spinal fluid is called a choroid plexus. There's a choroid plexus in the lateral ventricles. On the roof of the third ventricle, there's a choroid plexus. And kind of on the posterior wall of the fourth ventricle, there's a choroid plexus. So all these plexi are making cerebral spinal fluid, and indeed it flows from one chamber to the other. Right, it can flow from a lateral ventricle into a third ventricle via that interventricular foramen. Right, and once it's in the third ventricle, it can flow through the aqueductus sylvius or the cerebral aqueduct into the fourth ventricle, which is really small. And then from the fourth ventricle into the central canal, all the way down to the conus medullaris, and then back up through the space between the meninges. Ooh, who can remember that space between the meninges that carries cerebral spinal fluid? It's under which layer? It's underneath the arachnoid, so it's called the subarachnoid space that carries that cerebral spinal fluid back up to where? To this superior part of the brain where you have that arachnoid villus or arachnoid granulation, which then returns the CSF back to the circulatory system. So you have this flow pattern. That happens all the time. All right, there's a couple other ways that CSF can leave a ventricular system, and that's from the fourth ventricle. There is a median aperture right here where it can leave directly. Not all the CSF has to go into the central canal. And then there are lateral apertures as well from the fourth ventricle into the subarachnoid space, which then allows CSF to flow a little bit more of a direct route back to the superior sagittal sinus via these arachnoid granulations. And if any of these tubes get plugged in the brain, right, then CSF builds up in a part of the brain and it starts to compress that brain tissue, and a person's head will swell, right, during development producing hydrocephalus. You do have a picture of a newborn with hydrocephalus, right? And when cerebrospinal fluid builds up in the brain, it compresses the neuronal tissue. The brain can't develop normally, and that person doesn't have a normal brain, right? It's a very damaged brain when they're born, and they have a very short lifespan as a result of that. Oh, here you can see kind of an outline of the lateral ventricle, right here, with the choroid plexus in there. All right, and what is that condition called? What is this condition called? That is hydrocephalus, all right? And fortunately, it's becoming more of a rare and rare disease process, because with proper prenatal care, right, with ultrasound, it's very easy to diagnose this. And as a matter of fact, shunts can be placed before this baby's born to drain those ventricles or to make those different passageways patent so that the CSF will follow the correct flow pattern, and then that just prevents this from developing, right? And that's very, very nice, because you just save the individual's life by doing that. All right, so here is just a picture of choroid plexus. You can see a nice capillary right here and the external lining of these ependymal cells, and these ependymal cells are specialized to take plasma and reconstitute the plasma. Plasma is mostly water, but these ependymal cells also reconstitute it with glucose and oxygen and vitamins and a special mixture of ions, right? Higher levels of sodium and chloride, potassium, magnesium, which then help the function of the central nervous system. So that's kind of the job of the choroid plexus. So it's a combination of blood vessels and these neuroglia cells. All right, so guess what? I think we're pretty much done with the central nervous system. Oh, here's some interesting indexes about the choroid plexus. It makes about 500 milliliters of CSF every day. Who's got a 500-liter container of something? Probably not. That's like 250 mLs probably. All right, so your choroid plexus makes two of those bottles a day, and that has to flow through your central nervous system. So you can imagine if it can't drain back to your body, your brain would swell by that much every day if it was a complete blockage. Okay. All right, so the total volume is only about 100 to 150 mLs. All right, so it's not a huge space. So who's got a question on central nervous system? So you know what the difference between a tract and a ganglia is? How do signals enter or leave the spinal cord? Through, starts with an R, a root, right? Through a root, and how many roots are there? There are two, the ventral and dorsal. Which one is afferent? The dorsal root. You guys are telling me it doesn't look like this information's on the test on Monday, is it? No. You haven't been looking at this yet. Okay, well, maybe we'll review before the next exam, okay? All right, so let's close this down. Whoops, close it down. How do we close it down? We'll just move up over here. All right, so the next chapter, peripheral nervous system. So what the heck is a peripheral nervous system? It's everything where? All nervous tissue that is outside the brain and spinal cord, right? So it's outside the central nervous system, is peripheral nervous system. So we don't have tracts and nuclei in the peripheral nervous system, because where do we find those things? In the central nervous system. All right, so we're going to go to chapter 14. Chapter 14 right there, chapter 14 here. So what are the counterparts to nuclei and tracts in the peripheral nervous system? So in the central nervous system, there are nerve cell bodies and dendrites called a nucleus, right? It's this gray matter in the central nervous system. What do we call it in the peripheral nervous system? A ganglion, like, for instance, the dorsal root ganglion in the dorsal root that's in the peripheral nervous system. It's a bunch of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. All right, but what do we call myelinated axons in the peripheral nervous system? In the CNS, it's called a tract, but in peripheral nervous system, it's called a, it's just called a nerve, right? And we're going to look at the what a nerve really looks like. Okay, all right, so let me look at the word slide right here first, get it positioned. All right, so the peripheral nervous system, by function, could be broken down into two main ways. And that's because neurons only carry information one direction. All right, so there are nerves that are sensory, meaning they carry information to the brain, and then there are motor nerves that carry information from the central nervous system to what? Muscles and glands. And if it carries information to a skeletal muscle, we call that a somatic motor neuron. But if it carries it to smooth muscle, your heart, or to glands, those things you don't have control over, right? We call that a visceral motor neuron or an autonomic motor neuron. Or you could say automatic, but nobody says automatic, right? It's autonomic, which means what? Automatic. You don't have to think about it with your conscious thought. Somatic or voluntary only carry nerve impulses when you what? Think about initiating those commands in your primary motor cortex. Oh, where is your primary motor cortex at? And we're talking about cerebral cortex. That is the, what? Where's the motor at in your car? Okay, front. So it's the frontal lobe. It's what? The precentral gyrus is your primary motor cortex. Okay, sensory, on the other hand, right, can be broken down into somatic as well, from the surface of your body to what? The postcentral gyrus. And also, there's a visceral division, right, for sensation in visceral parts of your body, body cavities. We're not too familiar with sensations in those parts of your body because they don't misbehave very much. You're much more familiar with surface from the surface of your body. Okay. All right. So, for nerves that are leaving the central nervous system, there are two ways, and they can either leave from your brain. If they leave from your brain, we call those cranial nerves, but if they leave from your spinal cord, we just call them spinal nerves. And it just so happens that you have 12 pairs that leave from your brain and 31 pairs that leave from your spinal cord. We're not going to spend too much time with spinal cord. We're going to spend a little bit more time with cranial nerves. All right, and in order for you to sense something, right, you need to have a receptor, right, in the peripheral nervous system. And we can break receptors down into free nerve endings. We kind of talked about this when we talked about the integument system. Or they could be specialized receptor cells, like for Meissner's corpuscle or Pacinian corpuscle or Merkel's discs. All right, so we can classify them by location. If they sense things on the outside of your body, they're called exteroreceptors, like for touch, pressure, pain, and temperature, right? And most special sense organs like vision, where do you see light? On the inside of your body or outside your body? Outside, right? So that you see things on the outside of your body, that's an exteroreceptor. Now, you also have interoceptors that are located deep inside your body, like for visceral pain, for instance, if you're having an appendicitis, right, you have pain receptors around your intestines. You'll know something bad is happening, but you won't be able to localize it very well because you're just not familiar with processing pain information from deep inside your body. Right, nausea, hunger, sense of fullness, right, those are due to interoceptors. Another kind of interoceptor is a proprioceptor. And proprioceptors are located in muscles and also tendons and joint capsules. They tell your brain what position your body is in. So if I were to take your hand and have you close your eyes and tell you to leave go of your arm, just relax your arm, if I were to place your hand behind your head like that, you could tell me, oh, well, my hand is behind my head. Or I could put it up here and you could say, oh, my hand is above my head, even without looking. right? Because you have proprioceptors that tell your brain what position your body is in. Not just your hands, but all your joints and everything. That is proprioception, right? That, and those are in your periphery. The kinds of stimulus, right? Sometimes it's a mechanical stimulus, like somebody bumps up against you, right? Or pokes you with their finger, right? Those are mechanoreceptors. Vibration as well, vibration in your ear. That's a mechanical vibration. Those are picked up by mechanoreceptors. And then you have thermoreceptors for temperature, chemoreceptors for measuring what kinds of things? Chemicals, all right? Mostly, you have chemical detectors inside your body, but you have some that measure chemicals outside of your body, like where? Your tongue and your nose. The sense of olfaction and gustation can sense chemicals in your environment, right? But there are also central receptors that can measure pH in your body. There are glucose receptors in your body that can measure glucose, sugar, so it can help regulate blood glucose, right? And then you've got photoreceptors in your eye, and then nociceptors are just sensitive to pain. All right, so we talked about all these other things, but I do want to show you a picture with proprioceptors. Proprioceptors, here's a pretty good example. You've seen the integument before, but here are proprioceptors. What does this thing look like here, this red thing? Looks like a muscle, indeed. And a muscle is connected to a bone via a tendon. Okay. You've got a couple different kinds of proprioceptors, and you have these in all tendons and in all skeletal muscles in your body. So basically you have them where? All over your body, proprioception. Even though it takes a couple very interesting and complicated kinds of organs, a Golgi tendon organ right here can measure the tension that's placed in this tendon right here. So if this tendon starts to stretch, let's just say you're helping somebody move into a new house, and there are two guys carrying a refrigerator. How heavy is the refrigerator? Really heavy, okay? So two strong guys, and then all of a sudden, it slips out of the hands of one guy. So who's holding up the whole refrigerator? One person, right? So now you have the whole weight of that refrigerator that that guy is holding up. What's going to happen to this muscle and this tendon, right, when all of a sudden the whole weight of the refrigerator is being held up by one guy? It could stretch and it could rip, it could pull off of the bone right here, all right? But that won't happen because this Golgi tendon organ right here is going to say, whoa, way too much pressure is being exerted on this tendon. It's going to rip off the bone. And so what's going to happen is this is going to go back to the spinal cord and stimulate or actually inhibit the motor neuron to this muscle right here. And what's going to happen to the muscle? If it's inhibited, it's going to relax. And the other guy then is going to drop the refrigerator, and it's going to protect what? His muscles and tendons from being ripped to shreds. Okay? So that's one important function of proprioceptors. It's designed to protect the musculoskeletal system. All right, so another kind of proprioceptor is what we call a muscle spindle right here. And a muscle spindle is a way to control the proper contraction of this skeletal muscle so that it doesn't become too loose, because if this muscle becomes too relaxed, what's going to happen to you right now? Well, you're going to fall right out of your chair. If your muscles relax, right, and your head is going to bounce off the table and then off the chair and then off the floor, and it will be a big mess. So your muscle spindle is working with the spinal cord and cerebellum to maintain proper muscle tone to protect what? Not just your head, for instance, but what? All joints in your body, right? Because muscle tone protects joints. So these are what we call proprioceptors that maintain proper muscle tone. All right, and if all of a sudden a muscle starts to stretch, right, this muscle spindle can sense that stretching and send signals back to the spinal cord, and then the spinal cord is going to send signals to the skeletal muscle to contract to prevent that stretch from happening. Like in a knee-jerk reflex, when somebody taps your patellar ligament with a hammer or a mallet, that stretches the quadriceps, stimulating this muscle spindle, and to compensate for that inappropriate stretching of the muscle, to protect the muscle from overstretching, the muscle is going to oppose that stretch by contracting, right? And then your knee is going, or your foot is going to jerk up. That's what we call the knee jerk reflex. That's produced by these muscle spindles in muscles, proprioceptors. Okay. Peripheral motor endings. Muscles are innervated by a special kind of synapse. We looked at a synapse before. All right, what's a way of talking about a synapse? Yeah, it's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. And did we look at the neuromuscular junction when we looked at muscles? I don't have it in this diagram list right here. I don't want to take time to show you that, right? I don't want to take time to find it. But in a synapse, how does information go from the stimulating neuron to the receiving neuron? And what do we call those neurons? The sending neuron is the presynaptic neuron. The receiving neuron is the postsynaptic. And how does information go from the presynaptic to the postsynaptic neuron? As a chemical signal, namely a neurotransmitter. Well, the same thing for a nerve-muscle connection. The information travels as a chemical signal. So at the neuromuscular junction, you have a chemical synapse, and the motor neuron releases acetylcholine, which diffuses across the neuromuscular junction, and it binds to a receptor in the muscle. And in the muscle, another electrical impulse starts up when acetylcholine binds to it. Okay, and so muscles and nerves kind of act the same. Oh, there's got to be something in here regarding that. Let me put this away. That was it. I put that picture someplace. Oh, yeah, thanks for reminding me. All right, here's that neuromuscular junction. Here's the science sheet. All right, so here you have a motor neuron, a somatic motor neuron. Here is the axon terminus or axon swelling that contains synaptic vesicles filled with acetylcholine. When a nerve impulse comes down, that allows calcium to enter the synaptic terminus, which then causes the fusing of these synaptic vesicles to the presynaptic membrane, and then that exocytosis neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft, and that diffuses to the postsynaptic membrane, and that causes the development of another nerve impulse on this muscle cell that we call an action potential. It's the exact same kind of thing that happens in a neuron. And then that causes this muscle to contract. So here is a neuromuscular junction. And what did we want to say about this thing right here? All right, the neurotransmitter is acetylcholine. Okay, and that it's just a nice chemical synapse. All right, the other thing is a motor unit, but I think we talked about a motor unit already. Motor unit is, right, as one somatic motor neuron and the number of muscle fibers that it innervates. All right, so I see one blue motor neuron and one red motor neuron, and notice that the red one innervates more skeletal muscle. So when a nerve impulse comes down this motor neuron right here, it produces, what, a stronger or a weaker contraction to motor the blue motor unit right here. It's stronger, right? It's 50% stronger because it excites 50% more skeletal muscle fibers. Okay, well, the blue one right here only excites two. That will produce a weaker contraction. All right, so motor units, you got to know the definition of a motor unit. It's composed of how many motor neurons? One. And how many muscle fibers? Variable. All depends on what kind of control you need to have on your body, right? If it's going to be very fine control, then it's that one motor neuron is going to innervate very few muscle fibers. But if it's very coarse control, it could innervate thousands of muscle fibers, like, for instance, in your back. All right, so which type of motor unit has more precise control? Few muscle fibers per motor unit or many? For precise control would be few muscle fibers, like for your face or your hand, so that you have very fine control. Okay. All right, so where are we going to start looking at some of these nerves? Cranial nerves in particular. Now, where do cranial nerves come from? Where do they originate? From the brain. Yeah, from the brain. They arise from the brain. So let me go back to your particular textbook. Chapter 14. So let's look at those. All right, so here is something you're familiar with. What are these things here? It makes up the cerebellum, right? Then here is the cerebrum, right? Then we got pons and medulla. Below that is the spinal cord. So I really don't see spinal cord, but I see medulla, pons, cerebrum, cerebellum. And there are nerves that leave this part of the central nervous system, which is what you call the, what do you call this area right here of the central nervous system? That is your, yeah, that's your brain, okay? Cerebellum, pons, medulla, the cerebrum, that's part of your brain. So these nerves are what we call cranial nerves. And there are 12 of them. And they have names and they have numbers as well. They're numbered from anterior to posterior. And so just think of your face. What's the most anterior sense that you have on your face? That's your nose. And that's the sense of olfaction. So cranial nerve number one is the olfactory nerve. All right, so here's cranial nerve number one, and they go down through the cribriform plate and through your nasal cavity. All right, what's the second most anterior sense? Optic, right, or vision. All right, so here is the optic nerve. It crosses over at the optic chiasm and then enters the central nervous system. Those same fibers become the optic tract, right, because a tract is in the central nervous system. A nerve is in the peripheral nervous system, and the doorway between them right here is the optic chiasm. All right, the next one, oculomotor, that's cranial nerve number three. Trochlear, cranial nerve number four. Trigeminal right here is cranial nerve number five. So you just label them by number from anterior to posterior. Relatively easy to do. All right, but what's not so easy to do sometimes is to remember the name of the cranial nerve. And I'm gonna have you know all the names and numbers of the cranial nerves, but not all of their functions. I'll have a list of just what functions I want you to know. But eventually, you'll have to know the names and numbers and functions of all of these different nerves, all right, in your education, but not in anatomy class. All right, but if you want to learn it now, that might save you a little effort a little bit later on. So how do you know the names of some of these things? Let's look at the sheet right here. Okay. All right, so sometimes in anatomy and physiology and other sciences, we come up with a mnemonic. And a mnemonic is just a kind of a cute little saying that is easy to remember. All right, and the first letter of each word in the mnemonic corresponds to the first letter of the name of the list that you're trying to memorize. That makes no sense whatsoever. right? Like the correct order of cranial nerves is olfactory, right? Well, that sort of makes sense, right? Optic, that kind of makes sense. But when you get to oculomotor, who would have guessed? That would be cranial nerve number 3. Or trochlear number 4, trigeminal number 5, abducens, right, number 6. Then we got facial, vestibular, cochlear, glossopharyngeal, vagus is number 10, accessory is 11, and hypoglossal is 12. So how many cranial nerves are there? There are 12, right? So you got to know the number and the name right here. We're going to talk about some of these are real important, right, like the optic and olfactory. Vagus is real important. Right, because it helps control a lot of autonomic functions in your body, like decreasing heart rate. So these are the numbers, the names, and a very limited list of functions of these particular cranial nerves. So how are you going to know what name belongs in what position right here? From anterior to posterior, right, if we give you that diagram to label. But if it's just a multiple choice question, here is a mnemonic that I particularly like to use. And this mnemonic says, on old Olympus's towering top, a Finn and German viewed a hop. All right, so that makes perfect sense to me. And I don't know if it makes perfect sense to all of you guys, but what the heck is a hop? A hop is not something, in this particular case, is not something you do. It's an object that you make something with. What do you make with a hop? You make beer out of a hop. And who likes to drink beer? Well, Finns and Germans, I guess, but not just them, pretty much anybody in the world, but in particular, you know where Finland is and Germany is, right? These are European countries. And so these guys are sitting on top of a big mountain. In Europe, there's a huge mountain called Mount Olympus, right? And so these guys are sitting on top of what? And it's a very old mountain, so on old Olympus's towering top, which means what? It's much bigger than most mountains in the region, towering top. These two guys are viewing a hop. All right, so what does this H in hop correspond to? How many H's do you see in this mnemonic right here? I only see one. And how many cranial nerves have an H on them? There's only one. That's hypoglossal. And you know, where is it? Is it the first one? No, it's the last one. It's what? Number 12. Hypoglossal is the 12th cranial nerve. All right, so on right here stands for olfactory, old stands for optic, Olympus is oculomotor, right? So that can help you memorize, right, this list of cranial nerves. And what about viewed? What does that correspond to? It's two back from the last one, so that's got to be cranial nerve number 10, and that's the vagus nerve, right? And the vagus nerve is very important. It helps control autonomic functions in your body, and it kind of wanders around everywhere in your body. It arises from cranial nerve number 10, and you could count back on that figure which number 10 is. But it goes down through your neck and wanders around everywhere in your body, and that's how they came up with this name. What is a person that just kind of wanders around everywhere? A vagrant. Yeah, that starts with a V, and that's probably where this other term came from, but I was thinking of vagabond. Okay. So vagabond. Vagus comes from that term, I don't know which language, but vagabond. Okay, so what else is interesting right here? This T then is trochlear, the next T is trigeminal, A is abducens, all right, and that's an eye muscle. Guess what eye muscle that goes to? What's it going to do to the eye? It's going to abduct it, which means what? We only do one. You can't do with both eyes at the same time. You can, but what did your mom say? They could get stuck. Yeah, they could get, it doesn't happen, but don't do it anyway. Okay, what is abduction? Toward midline or away from midline? Okay, abduction is toward midline. Abduction is away from midline. So the abducens goes to what muscle in the eye? The one that contracts an eyeball so that it rotates laterally, which is, what does a muscle do? Can it push or pull? It can only pull, so what muscle, when it pulls on the eye, rotates it laterally? It's got to be the lateral rectus muscle, right? So the abducen just goes to the lateral rectus muscle that causes abduction of the eye on one side. Okay, facial is for taste, right? That's fin. And right here, that A right there stands for vestibular cochlear, right? And then G in German stands for glossopharyngeal. So it makes perfect sense. Any questions on that? No questions on that one? How come nobody's asking me a question? I set it up for you guys to ask a good question. Why is there an A, okay, right here when there's a V in vestibulocochlear? Right? And you'll know exactly why that is. It's not because a V is an upside down A, somebody could say that, but because cranial nerve number 8 used to be called the auditory nerve because it's important for hearing. But we now know it's important more for not just hearing, but also for balance. It goes to the cochlea, which you use for hearing, but also the vestibular apparatus, which you use for balance. So we kind of simplified this term to make it more sense. So instead of calling it the auditory nerve, we call it the vestibulocochlear nerve, which means hearing and balance both together. So when we get into the special senses chapter, you'll see how that is. All right, so there's a nice mnemonic. Now, you might not like my mnemonic. You might think of one your own. If you come up with one of your own mnemonics, then you'll probably remember it a whole lot better. All right, but you can also go to medicalmnemonics.com and look it up and look up a whole bunch of mnemonics. People sit around in the evening coming up with mnemonics for various kinds of things, right? But make sure you put the filter on and filter out the X-rated mnemonics, all right? Because I don't want people to be writing down X-rated mnemonics on their test, right? So that's forbidden in this class, all right, to do that. Your book also has another mnemonic, which I don't remember, which works just fine. Okay. Now, like spinal, oh, we're not quite done with lecture yet, so hold on, you guys, hold on. All right, so where do these cranial nerves come from? From the brain, not the spinal cord, because nerves that come from the spinal cord are called what kind of nerves? Spinal nerves. And remember, we looked at spinal nerves, how they enter or leave the spinal cord, and how do they enter? As mixed? Or is afferent or efferent, or how does that go? The roots are one way, right? They're either afferent or efferent. But cranial nerves sometimes are efferent, sometimes they're afferent, and sometimes they're mixed, all right? And so here is a way that you can remember which cranial nerve has what kind of function, all right? So if it has an S, that means it is what, an afferent nerve, right? If it's got an M, that means that it's an efferent, and if it's a mixed, then it's going to get a B in this particular mnemonic. So here's a little saying, all right? Some say money matters, but my brother says big brains matter most. Okay, so here's a little mnemonic to help you figure out which cranial nerve. So cranial nerve is what kind of nerve? It is an afferent nerve, 100% afferent. And does that make sense? Olfaction? Well, yeah, because you don't transmit anything to your nose to make it work. It's what? It's reception. What about your eyes? Okay, that's purely sensory. All right, and then what's number two? Oh, what's number two? I mean number three. Number three is oculomotor. All right, and what we got for motor? Oh, M. That makes good sense, right? All right, but every once in a while, right, like brother right here, that is what, a mixed nerve. So cranial nerves can be 100% sensory sometimes, 100% motor, or they can carry mixed signals, all depends on the particular cranial nerve. All right, so the bottom line is, this is an exam figure, so make sure you can label these cranial nerves for the lecture exam. All right, and I think these are even in your lab manual for the practicum when you get to the nervous system practicum. So that will help you remember that as well. All right, so that's it for today's lecture. Where's that sign-in sheet at? Where's the sign-in sheet? Who's got it? I'm going to have to start patting people down. Okay.
Is this for Monday? The lecture exam?
No. Lecture exam does not have this chapter. It just has introduction to muscles, the muscle chapter, and introduction to nervous system, but not CNS. Yeah. I abbreviated that list to make it easier to remember.
But the sensory has like both.
Yeah. It does have both. I'm just having you know one thing. Yeah. Just to make it simpler. So when you guys get into a nursing program, make sure you remember all these mnemonics. Because you got to know everything about the cranial nerves in a nursing program. Okay. Then you got to know cranial nerves for optometry, though. Because your eyes, muscles that control the eyes, vision.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not allowing people to do that.
I'm just thinking about I'm already doing that. I don't want to read it. At least this is the only one I'm doing this.
I think at the end of the semester,